Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
Welcome to True Crime Cast. I am Jamie, and John is here too. What is up?
Dude, not a whole lot. I mean, I feel like a Noah's Ark situation is happening. We recorded Bless Their Hearts earlier this week, and you talked about how nice the weather was, and now I think it's rained a foot, like no joke. It's been a lot of rain. Yep. Flooding,
tornado warnings. We live in Kentucky, so pretty much from St. Louis to here and then down in Arkansas, it's been not a fun weather week.
I got to spend time at 3 a.m. at your house in your tornado shelter. I've been telling people at work this week that, you know, what's better than having your own boat, having a friend with a boat, and a tornado shelter?
Yeah.
And a pool.
Wow.
Please don't ever move.
I need better friends. But no, it's a peace of mind having it and sharing a small metal box with 12 people and 3 dogs is exactly how I wanted to spend my evening. So all good.
It wasn't as bad as it sounds. Hey, in good news, I want to say thank you to a couple of people. And those people are Jake and Ducky. So Jake came in over on Patreon at the $3 level, but took advantage of an annual membership. So thank you, Jake. And then Ducky came in at the $10 a month level. So Ducky, on top of getting the regular bonus episodes, you're also going to get some sweet swag. So thank you so much.
Yep. Thanks, Ducky. Glad you are here. I also have a thank you for a new 5-star review over on Apple Podcasts. This comes from Yoda Boston. Solid username. I love the tone of both podcasters. They speak with clarity and empathy. Thank you.
And who is that?
Yoda Boston.
Yoda Boston. Hey, going back to Ducky, she gets a special shout out. So Jamie, can you do the honors?
Yeah, she does. I thought I'd misunderstood the assignment there, but no, Ducky, it's people like you that keep us going. The reason we're still doing this, the reason we get opportunities like being invited to CrimeCon, we have a code Ducky. We would love to meet you out there. If you want to join us at, it's in Denver this year. You can use code CrimeCast to get 10% off your badge. And it's going to be a great time. But yeah, we wouldn't get to do this stuff if it wasn't for folks like Ducky.
Be prepared, guys, to see some social media posts about that badge coupon for CrimeCon. Please take advantage of it. Share it with your friends. I mean, who knows? Maybe you know somebody in the area and they want to pop over for a day. Give them the gift of some savings.
Absolutely. John, I mean, I don't know. I feel like I'm in a good mood and I'm excited. And then we jump into crime and I don't know. Obviously, we find this super interesting, but death is not always a good time.
It's not, but we're going to do our best to tell you this story. And remember, it's not just a story. This is someone's real life. So let's talk about what happened. And with that being said, why don't you get the ball rolling?
Heather Bogle was a devoted single mother, and her whole life revolved around her daughter, whose name was Mackenzie. Heather even took a job working nights at the Whirlpool factory in Sandusky, Ohio, just so she would have more time during the day to spend with her 5-year-old little girl. Heather's sister Jen would say her main focus was always her daughter. She wasn't too concerned about getting into a relationship. It was being responsible and taking care of her kid, making sure she was working enough hours to support them both. As a working parent, I completely empathize with this. It's very much a balance of I have to work enough to make sure we get what we need, and I want my kids to have the things they want, but I also want to be with them, and that's a struggle, and especially for a single parent. So Heather was working her butt off, and that's why it was especially strange when she didn't show up to school to pick Mackenzie up on the day of April 9th, 2015.
I'm going to stop there. Have we done this case, man? Heather's mother kept reaching out to her, but she was not able to get in touch with her, and no one else had heard from her either. Her sister said, quote, "We instantly knew something was wrong when she didn't pick up Mackenzie. Her life was her daughter. And for her not to show up, that was not her. end quote. And that's precisely when the police were called. So Heather was last seen clocking out of her night shift job at a manufacturing facility for Whirlpool. This was at 6:17 a.m. on April the 9th, 2015. So the next day, police made a horrible discovery. They found Heather's Oldsmobile, and it was an Oldsmobile Alero. It was found, and when they opened the trunk, they saw Heather's body. Her body appeared as if it had been beaten. Her wrists and ankles were bound. There were defensive wounds on her hands. She had two gunshot wounds to her chest. This is devastating. She also looked to be in a shirt that had been perhaps not hers. She was in an oversized Mickey Mouse shirt that had little blood on it, no bullet holes. So this indicated to police right off the bat that Heather's shirt was not, like, the shirt she was wearing was not her shirt, and someone had put it on her after she died. Oddly, her hair had also been cut off and in a jagged pattern almost down to the scalp. So it's like someone just basically scalped this poor girl's hair off.
Yeah. And I immediately wonder, was this part of the attack? Did they have a reason for this? Was this a way to, I don't know, hide evidence? I don't know. That was my first thought when I heard about that. Also, her body appeared to have been cleaned. Again, maybe in an effort to destroy any DNA evidence that was left. The car had been abandoned in a parking lot of an apartment complex that seemed to have no connection to Heather or really anybody she knew. So it seems to be abandoned in somewhat of a random location. And of course, that's where she and her car were found. Goes without saying, her family was devastated. They were in shock. It's really hard to comprehend something like this happening when it comes completely out of the blue, especially when, you know, somebody's not, I don't know, no risk, not really at risk for something like this. And by at risk, I mean being in certain relationships or being involved in scenarios where you may expect something like this to happen. That wasn't the case for Heather at all. And the case immediately was given to Detective Sean O'Connell as the lead investigator.
O'Connell didn't have much evidence to go on, so he started at the apartment complex where her body was found, and that's kind of where this investigation started. One witness told O'Connell that he saw someone parking the vehicle sometime between 1:30 and 3 a.m. on April the 10th. They said the driver was wearing a hoodie, then they got out of the car and just simply walked away. So O'Connell thought Heather had been killed near where the car was found, so he brought cadaver dogs to the apartment complex. So the dog signaled at the home of a 25-year-old single mom named Kiana Bohr. O'Connell was already familiar with Kiana. He knew the father of her child, and that was a local drug dealer. After Heather's autopsy showed marijuana in her system, O'Connell theorized that Heather had gone to one of the apartments to buy drugs, and he narrowed down his suspicions to Omar Satchel.
Omar was somebody who was friends with Kiana, and he had a criminal past. O'Connell had seen surveillance footage that appeared to show a white SUV driving into the complex not long after Heather's car was allegedly dropped around there the same day. The footage was so grainy and blurred, it was impossible to tell the actual make and model of the vehicle, so you can basically just see color and that it was an SUV. But O'Connell found a photo on social media of Omar sitting next to a white SUV, so it at least wouldn't exclude him on being somebody who could be involved based on that vehicle, and again, assuming the vehicle picked up the person who dumped the car. He was so confident, in fact, that he publicly named Omar, Kiana, and one other suspect publicly within a few months of starting the investigation. So, of course, that was picked up on. Local papers were running stories, putting up mugshots of Omar and putting that he was a murder suspect, plastering it all around the area.
So the problem was, however, there was a big conflict of interest with O'Connell accusing Kiana. She said that there was blood between her and O'Connell, like bad blood. Kiana said O'Connell had a personal vendetta against her and her child's father, and he was looking for a familiar face in the right place and at the right time. She alleged O'Connell made up the story that the cadaver dog went to her home. Omar also alleged that O'Connell was using him as the perfect scapegoat because he was a black man with a criminal record. He always maintained that he did not know Heather Bogle, never met her, and he even volunteered his DNA to prove this. Heather had managed to get her attacker's DNA under her fingernails, and that DNA, well, it did not match Omar or Kenyana. Omar said that he had an alibi for the day Heather was killed, and that photo O'Connell found was him sitting in a white SUV. That photo was over 2 years old, apparently.
And, I mean, that even with, even if that was taken the day before, that doesn't prove anything. It just doesn't exclude him as a suspect. They're like, we know he doesn't have access to a white SUV. That could exclude him, but that's not the case. So at this point, Omar and Kiana are pointing out flaws in the investigation. They're complaining that they have been, I don't know if set up is the right word, but falsely accused and in a lot of ways set up for having committed this crime, whether it's because of tunnel vision on behalf of O'Connell or because he had something out against them. But they weren't the only ones that were unhappy with the investigation, which I think this is something we don't see as often, John. Heather's family didn't think O'Connell was doing a good job and that he was on the right trail in solving Heather's murder. Her sister came out publicly and said, "My gut instinct was that Sean just wasn't doing what he was supposed to be doing. Everything he was doing was wrong." They believed that Heather's killer was someone she knew, and they had their own theories.
I mean, just looking at how her body was found, like when I saw that her hair had been like cut crazy short, I don't know that I've ever saw an FBI profiler say this, but my first thought was this was someone that she knew and had a big beef with her. Like, why would you, removing her hair doesn't, I don't know what it benefits the person other than to get out rage. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it absolutely seems personal unless there's some kind of, I don't know, serial killer with a weird hair fetish that keeps it for trophies, but there was no indication of that here. So I think you're right. I think the most logical scenario is that that meant it was personal and the person that committed this knew Heather and wanted to go the extra mile to hurt her while killing her and disposing of her body. One thought was actually that Heather's brother may be involved. This was her older brother, and his name was Josh. He had recently sent Heather some really demeaning text messages earlier in the day that she disappeared. Heather was trying to get out of the factory business and become a nurse, and she had actually failed the nursing exam. Josh sent her messages that day that said that she was too stupid to pass the test and that she was typical trash. Not much of a supportive sibling here. Heather's sister would say that Josh knew how to get under Heather's skin. Josh would later say that those text messages were his way of trying to motivate his sister through tough love. He said, "I felt in my mind if I shamed Heather, I'll shame her into doing the right thing. But it was the wrong approach, clearly, and it was abusive." You know, I don't know if I buy what he said, but sending mean text messages also doesn't make you a killer.
Yeah, I mean, look, you can read those and they sound terrible, not denying that, but siblings have a different relationship. You're not my sibling, but I think of you a lot as a brother. And if I did something, like if I was going out for a certification at work and I failed it, I don't think you're going to be like, "Oh man, go get it next time." You'd be like, "Idiot, try harder next time."
Right. Yeah.
I would know that's your loving way of saying, "Hey man, it's all right. And it's going to be okay." I don't know that that's the case either, but I don't think you can. You're certainly not going to go to court and say, "Well, he sent some mean texts, so I think he killed his sister."
Yeah, that's not certainly not definitive evidence.
There was another potential suspect that popped up in this case, and the suspect suggested, actually by the family, was Heather's love interest, Carmela Badillo. Heather and Carmela met at work, and Carmela said that she was drawn to Heather's spirit, but the two often had jealousy issues and they would fight often. In fact, just before she disappeared, the two actually had a breakup. When Heather was found, there was a note from Carmela on the car's front seat, and in it, Carmela told Heather, "You're dead to me." Look, love interests fight, they break up, and you say stuff that you don't mean. But when that note that says "you're dead to me" is found in the car, which has the dead body of Heather, that's quickly going to put you as a suspect, or at least it should.
Yeah, I think it hits a little different for sure if that's the scenario, because that's a very, very uncommon scenario. And while, you know, people want to get their point across, I think it just shows that we need to be extra careful with our words.
It's like the tube of toothpaste. You can say it, but you can't ever put it back in the tube, right? Now, I'm going to also just stop and ask you a question here. Like, if you're O'Connell and you see this note, why do you immediately disregard it, not follow up on that, and then immediately start pursuing this other option? And maybe it was because the cadaver dog did hit on that house, but I don't know. It seems like someone I would want to talk to, right?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the lead should, well, is always the significant other, last person to see them. And Carmela at least falls into one of those boxes, and Kiana and Omar really didn't.
Carmela said that she did not understand the weight of those words, and she took Heather for granted. There was even a question of a fight the two had over Heather's hair. Carmela allegedly did not like a new haircut that Heather had, but she said that it was blown way out of proportion.
But again, you're fighting over the hair and the hair's cut. Now that's out of her control if she didn't like the haircut, but unless she's the one that cut it, of course, it's just, it feels off, right?
It's more circumstantial evidence, right?
Right. I think it is. And we get back, we'll talk about some more evidence that was dug into by O'Connell and whether or not he actually was leading them to Heather's killer. Both of these individuals were flagged to O'Connell, but Heather's family grew more and more frustrated. They felt that he was dismissing their suspicions because they didn't fit into his compact little theory that this was just a drug deal gone wrong. He was very focused on this being a drug deal and seemed to ignore all suggestions that didn't fit into that. O'Connell wasn't communicating with the family, and I know that is touchy. I know there are some things you can share, some things you want to share, and some things you definitely can't share, but the family was starting to feel like Heather's case would never be solved. And then things really shook up at the sheriff's office. O'Connell's boss, Sheriff Kyle Overmeyer, was not often around the office and knew very little about Heather's case when reporters called him and asked for official updates to be given to the public. That's because Overmeyer was preoccupied with stealing prescription drugs from the drop box at the local police department. He also misused public funds, lied to doctors in order to get more prescription pain medication. Ultimately, he pled guilty to all of this fraud and misconduct and was sentenced to 4 years in prison. So not only do they not have faith that this is getting the attention that it needs, they now see that there was no oversight, no accountability to this case either. They had to lose all faith at this point, John.
Around this same time, Detective O'Connell came under some investigation and scrutiny himself, and this time the scrutiny was by the state attorney general's office because they didn't feel like he was really handling Heather's case well. There were allegations that he had tampered with evidence and that he even coerced witnesses to fit his theory of what happened to Heather. He denied these allegations, but as they continued to investigate his actions, O'Connell actually resigned from the sheriff's office. He ended up managing a McDonald's. That's a big difference going from a detective job to managing a McDonald's.
That's a big swing. And also, I don't know, like, what qualified him to be a restaurant manager? I don't even have faith that he's going to do that job well.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't think professionally you make that move unless you are forced to make that move, right? Like, I don't think that's a job, like, that's not a lateral position, I would not
certainly
think.
Not a career trajectory you would expect, yeah.
In January 2017, Chris Hilton took office as sheriff, and he vowed to make Heather Bogle the case that was the one at the top of his priority list. He put Major Nick Kostopoulos on the case as his lead investigator. They also brought in the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation to look into Heather's GPS records. Hilton said, quote, "I knew it was a solvable case. I just knew it had to be done right. I said we were going to open this up from the point where it had just happened. Every lead, every person, everybody's a suspect until we can eliminate them. And that's what we did," end quote. And honestly, if I have to step into an investigation like that, that's, I don't know, that's how I would approach it. I know that when my people working a case have to leave for whatever reason, they take a different job or whatever, I will catch up the new person on what's been done, but I will tell them, work this case as your own, start over from scratch, don't leave a stone unturned.
Completely agree. And especially, like, I would advise that even if the investigation was done well, but since it was done so poorly, I think you have to just start completely from scratch, not only to get your own interpretation, but to see fresh eyes help everything, right? Whether you're solving a murder, working a social work case, looking for the keys around the house. Like, I can tell you everywhere I looked, but that doesn't mean anything to you. You need to check everywhere. Fresh eyes can mean the world in any kind of search or investigation. Kostopoulos took the case, which he called a mess, and he looked into every potential suspect. No surprise to really anybody, it didn't take him long to rule out Omar and Kiana, pointing out that there was zero evidence linking them to Heather or linking them to the crime. It was certainly a leap to try to connect them to Heather in the first place, and he didn't want to waste any of his time there. He used the DNA evidence to rule out Heather's brother Josh and to rule out Heather's girlfriend Carmela. After clearing the known suspects, Kostopoulos decided that he did have to start over after all these other suspects were out of the way and go back to the original evidence. He started with Heather's cell phone records. The last ping from her phone came about 9:20 in the morning on April 9th. Again, the last time she's seen is just after 6 a.m. So about 3 hours later, her phone stopped pinging the towers. Investigators were able to narrow down the location to a 5-mile radius, but Google was able to be even more accurate. It seems that her phone, when it last pinged, was at a trailer in the Emerald State Trailer Park. The trailer she was near belonged to a man named Daniel Myers, who also worked at Whirlpool with Heather. So we have a location of her phone, and we have a person at that home connected to her at work. So this suspect makes more sense than anybody else we've talked about. And it's just one sentence.
I hate to throw O'Connell under the bus a little bit, because maybe he did have this information, but I doubt it. I mean, if he had this information, I don't think we'd be here today.
Yeah, you know? I don't think he looked for it. I think that's kind of the part of the problem. I think he just went on what he wanted to go on. And then this other information he didn't even try to get because he thought he had the right people.
I would be really interested to sit down with some of my detective friends and talk about their approach to cases. And we have several resources in order to do that with, but I think you have to get a picture of, okay, last seen at 6:17, she clocked out. Where'd she go? Who else clocked out? I can't imagine at Whirlpool that she was the only individual to clock out at that time. Usually they have shifts. People come in shifts and people leave as shifts. Who saw her leave?
But, and clocking in and out's an official, like, logged activity. It's something that you can track back.
Yeah. I mean, you could subpoena Whirlpool to get their records to see who clocked out around that same time.
Yeah.
Because you'd imagine they'd be walking to the same parking lot.
And that's either step one or two of this investigation. Should have been, I would think.
In May 2017, authorities were able to get a search warrant for his DNA and his home. And when they looked through the trailer, they noticed floorboards inside had been replaced less than a week after Heather Bogle's death. Initially, Meyer said that he barely knew Heather. But as investigators took a closer look at him, they found out that he had attended Heather's funeral and donated $125 to the GoFundMe that was started by Heather's family. They also talked to his dentist. And they found out that he had a broken tooth fixed 3 months after Heather Bogle's murder. Then the DNA results came back. The DNA under Heather's fingernails, they matched Daniel Myers. The tooth was proof that Heather tried to fight back. She fought back. She had defensive wounds on her hands, on her arms. She fought back so hard that she broke this guy's tooth. He replaced the floorboards because there was likely blood and evidence that would be on those boards to put her body at the scene of his house.
Absolutely. And this is all great investigative work. Like, I would love to see the trail of conversations that led to the dentist. Like, how did he start looking into medical records and figure that out? Like, when is calling somebody's dentist on your list of things to do? So I find that interesting, but it ends up being super, super important. So big kudos to Kostopoulos for this investigation. Because this is not the only woman in Myers' past who ended up dead. Investigators quickly learned that his ex-girlfriend, whose name was Leanne Sluder, had died 6 years before Heather had. Now, this event was ruled a suicide, but her sister never believed that to be the case. She had always thought that Daniel Myers had killed her sister. Leanne was found with a gunshot wound to the chest and a .22 caliber rifle laying beside her. Now, we've talked about cases that have been ruled suicides like this before. For example, Kurt Cobain. And that's one where there was alleged suicide by a rifle. And we talked at length about the actual physics of that. And in this way, shooting yourself in the chest with a rifle would be even harder, I think, than getting to your head. So it's tough to tie that into a suicide, but that's what authorities went with initially. When Myers came under suspicion for Heather's death, though, they decided to reopen Leanne's investigation. There was very little evidence, and unfortunately, they were never able to get the coroner to change Leanne's cause of death. So she was never classified as a homicide victim, so he was never able to be charged for her murder. Myers agreed to plead guilty to Heather's murder, kidnapping, and assaulting her in exchange for them taking the death penalty off the table, which is a very common deal. We talked about this recently, about how often prosecutors will consult the family before making a decision about this. We don't know that happened, but really hopeful that it did. He was sentenced to life behind bars without the possibility of parole. The sheriff called Myers a monster. It's believed that he lured Heather to his trailer in order to have sex with her, and when she refused, he attacked her. They also believe that chopping her hair off was a way of him trying to get rid of any DNA that he could have left, as maybe he had pulled her hair, dragged her by her hair, or something like that. So it wasn't necessarily about it being personal, even though he was a very angry, aggressive man. It was more about trying to clean up after himself. So Myers admitted it. He did it. He was a very logical suspect, and he was led to immediately by the cell phone data and by the fact that he worked with her. It seems like this could have been wrapped up really quickly.
I mean, I'm not a detective, Jamie, but I feel like I could have worked this case and achieved the same outcome if I would have been on the case initially.
And you sound hesitant to throw O'Connell under the bus. I think he threw himself under there.
Well, let's talk more about O'Connell briefly. In December of 2017, he was actually charged, and he was charged for tampering with evidence that related to the Heather Bogle case. And on September of 2018, he actually pled guilty to felony tampering with evidence, and he was sentenced to 2 years in prison. You want to know the most ironic part of all that? He's actually held in the same prison where Daniel Myers was serving. So both of these guys in jail, one for murdering Heather Bogle and the other for basically going to measures to help Myers cover up a murder, even though he wasn't doing it for Myers' sake.
He was trying to set somebody else up, trying to
that
set
up Keanu. That is the dirtiest of dirty, man.
And Omar. Yeah, it really is. And you don't often see police get held accountable for things like this. Like sometimes they'll be fired.
I would think it's because it doesn't happen a lot. But
I don't know. Of course, I watch too many movies, and that it takes a really almost every movie has a dirty cop, right? So it's I guess that's in the back of my head. I hope it doesn't happen often, but I'm thrilled to see that he was actually held legally accountable for that.
For sure. This was crazy. There's so many twists and turns in this one, but at the end of the day, I'm just so thankful that Heather, her family, her daughter, they can at least say they have justice for her. They'll never get Heather back, and that's the tragedy of this story, but at least they know what happened.
They do. They have some answers, and like you said, that won't bring her back. That's never enough, but it's better than not having answers.
For sure.
And I don't know. I don't think we've had this conversation in a long time, but we also always used to ask, was justice served at the end of every episode? And I think we don't talk about this anymore because I feel like maybe we've landed at a place of, you know, there is no justice in bringing somebody without bringing somebody back. And that's not something that's possible. But this is the, I guess, best solution possible for the family, best outcome after the death took place. So I think it's the best we can do.
For sure. Jamie, thank you for helping me cover this one. Mackenzie, our writer, thank you for getting this one wrote up. And this one was I want to say a good case to cover, but tragic all the same.
It was. And I mean, like I said, the loose ends were tied up. Even the cop who was trying to sabotage somebody, and the right people were cleared before they went to prison. There was a lot of wrong that happened here after the murder, but all of that was put right at some point.
O'Connell's probably out of prison at this time, right?
But, yeah, he should be. Probably for a while.
I will say that I hope he had a miserable time in prison. I can't imagine prison would be easy for a former detective. And I hope that it was awful.
What's that situation like in the mess hall when he walks by Myers?
I would imagine that he had to be in protective custody of some kind, right?
Yeah, I think it's always, I don't know. It's always sketchy when an officer goes to prison.
I mean, I don't know. Between Myers and O'Connell, things might have been pleasant. Like Myers potentially happy with O'Connell. Like, thanks, man.
He kept
really worried about getting caught for this, but you really helped me out for a while.
Yeah, I know I ended up in here anyway, but thanks for the effort.
Also, can I get a McFlurry?
Like, right. Yeah. That McDonald's took a big L on this one. Nope. Fantastic case to talk about. Of course, a tragic situation, but justice was very close to being served there at the end. So, guys, we appreciate you listening. Would love your feedback on this one if you have a different take. Been getting a lot of messages, some very interesting ones from folks involved in some cases. So
yeah, that one, man, I'd love to talk more about that. Maybe we'll put some information on Patreon if that one comes through.
Yeah, it's a good idea. Of course, we're a little, I would say, gun shy to talk about stuff, but we'll get there.
All right. Guys, we appreciate you. If you don't care, please take a moment to leave a rating and a review. And until next crime, this has been True Crimecast.
You've listened to True Crimecast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.